The Environmental Protection Agency finalizes the first ever federal standards to cut methane emissions from the oil and gas industry. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick reports that it's part of the Obama administration's broader plan to combat climate change.
Methane is the main component of natural gas. It's much more potent than carbon dioxide as a heat-trapping greenhouse gas. The EPA says new scientific data shows methane emissions are much higher than previously thought, and nearly one-third of that pollution comes from the oil and gas sector. Agency Administrator Gina McCarthy says the proposed standards will target both new and existing infrastructure.
It will reduce air pollution that directly harms public health, and it will make sure that the oil and gas industry can continue to operate safely and responsibly.
The industry trade group, the American Petroleum Institute, issued a statement calling the measures unreasonable and costly, warning they could put the nation's domestic drilling boom at risk. Earlier this year, Governor Tom Wolf's administration announced it was also working on new rules to curb methane leaks from the state's oil and gas industry. Marie Cusick, State Impact Pennsylvania.
In Philadelphia, the tradition known as councilmanic prerogative gives city council members power over land use in their districts. The day after a federal jury found one councilman abused that power, WHYY's Katie Colneri reports that his colleagues are brushing off the verdict.
The jury found Councilman Kenyatta Johnson blocked the sale of two properties to retaliate against developer Ori Feibusch, who ran against Johnson in last year's primary. The councilman was ordered to pay $34,000 in damages. It was the first time councilmanic prerogative has been challenged in court. So will this verdict make any council members think twice before using that power?
Not at all, because I'm never going to abuse it.
Councilman Curtis Jones says it's a useful tool in a city that's seeing rapid redevelopment.
Sometimes communities suffer because they have too little. Other times communities suffer because they have too much. And in that fine line is the council person and his discretion about what the people truly need.
Even though the jury found Johnson abused this power, Councilwoman Maria Quinones-Sanchez is defending him.
Those types of isolated incidents taken out of context can look bad when in fact you are trying to serve the best interest.
Sanchez says Feibusch, who has a reputation for being outspoken and aggressive, just didn't want to take no for an answer. As for Johnson, he insists he was only trying to set aside land for affordable housing. His lawyers are appealing the decision.
We believe the ruling has wider implications as it relates to how we do our jobs as council people, and most importantly, use our discretion to effectively advocate.
Johnson says he's confident the tradition of councilmanic prerogative will continue into the future. Katie Colneri, WHYY News.
Water companies and other utilities are sounding an alarm and trying to drum up revenue to improve the services they provide. From the WHYY Health Desk, Tanya English reports that they're emphasizing how it matters to more than government budgets.
The idea is to call attention to pipes, bridges, and other bones of a community that people don't often think about until something goes wrong.
If you look at what happened, say, in Flint, Michigan, where they didn't take care of their water infrastructure, you can see that taking care of water infrastructure is very important for the public health and public well-being.
That's Andy Cricken from the Camden County Municipal Utilities Authority. He says in South Jersey, Camden is planting rain gardens, opening parks, and replacing pipes to improve the city's combined stormwater and sewer system.
The useful life of a sewer pipe is about 70 to 80 years, so much of Camden's combined sewer system is past that, and that's true for a lot of urban cities.
Combined waste and stormwater systems can be a big source of pollution and a very expensive one to fix. For the first time this year, Camden is also hiring young adults to do park maintenance. The program, called Power Corps, will teach 18 to 25-year-olds about green ways to manage water. Several years ago, the American Society of Civil Engineers issued a report card for the nation's infrastructure, and America earned a D+, just above a failing grade. I'm Tanya English, WHYY News.
Let's go next to Hunterdon County, New Jersey, known for its historic towns, rural landscapes, and some of the highest incomes in the state. What's not as obvious is the county's homeless population. WHYY's Joe Hernandez reports that advocates are struggling to combat the unseen homeless problem.
When her sister died in 2012, Christine Lance left their Flemington apartment and became homeless. She couch surfed, stayed with friends, and after 3 years was paying by the night at a local hotel.
I hated having to worry every night where I was going to sleep, so I applied here and thank God they took me in.
Here is Family Promise of Hunterdon County, a nonprofit that provides shelter and services to homeless families and single women. Colleen Dewar is the development director.
When they come to us, they're not typically sleeping on the street. More often than not, they are doubled up in someone's home, or they're sleeping in a hotel, self-paying at a hotel, and not a nice one. Sometimes we'll have people that come to us having slept in their cars.
But as Dewar says, they're not on the streets of the suburban and often rural county, and advocates say that's what makes Hunterdon's homeless population unique and often invisible. Dewar says many residents she's talked to are surprised there are homeless people in one of New Jersey's richest counties.
The other thing that has surprised people in the past is I've had comments from people who say, well, wait a second, how can you tell me that someone can be working and be homeless? That's a real disconnect.
Advocates say the working homeless often have low-paying jobs and can't afford the county's high housing prices. The United Way estimates a family of four needs $76,000 a year to live in Hunterdon County.
We live in a very wealthy county. That means we have very high rents. We also have a lot of jobs that are at or just above minimum wage. And so there's a gap there that causes a lot of people to become homeless or, for sure, in a poverty situation.
For Jen Shore, who runs the County Division of Housing, one solution is more low-cost, tightly clustered housing developments, different from the sprawling properties typical of the area. But Shore acknowledges that in the bedroom communities of Hunterdon County, that probably won't be a popular idea.
If we as a community decide that we really need to have diversity in our community, economically, racially, all of those things, then we really need to look at having lower density housing and really figure out what those mortgages and rents would look like to be able to have affordable housing for minimum wage workers.
Until that happens, the Hunterdon homeless will have to make do with what services are available and what groups like Family Promise can offer. But even there, the shelter is not a full-time operation. Clients stay at Family Promise offices during the day and sleep in local churches at night. This weekend, Family Promise is holding its annual Box City fundraiser. That's an event where participants raise money for the shelter and sleep in a box outside a local high school overnight. Last year, the group raised $26,000. But to put that in perspective, that's just one-third of what one family needs to live in Hunterdon County. And the shelter sees more than a dozen families each year. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
Still ahead this evening, researchers crunch the numbers to figure out if laptops are beneficial in the classroom.
Schools have been spending billions of dollars over the past decade or so to give devices and specifically laptops to all of their students, and making that investment with really very little understanding of how it's going to impact student learning.
NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY.
Ever hear a news story about business or the economy and go, man, why do I care? Yeah, not on Marketplace.
We've seen stocks go wild.
Customer has gotten really impatient.
Okay, first of all, we're talking about awards, Kai.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's the business news of the day. For the rest of us, it's next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Marketplace follows NewsWorks Tonight at 6:30 this evening on WHYY.
Proudly supporting WHYY, Camp Hill Special School, an accredited Waldorf school with day and boarding options dedicated to redefining what is possible for children and youth with special needs. Students not only study visual arts, music, and crafts, but contribute to the community as a whole by taking part in festivals, caring for animals, participating on student council, and fulfilling meaningful roles in their on-campus homes. Offering a campus tour on May 18th at 9 a.m. Details at camphill.org.
Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. Do test scores improve when schools provide laptops to each student? Let's look for answers based on a new analysis of data with Education Week's Ben Harreld. Ben, welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
Your article out this week is entitled "One-to-One Laptop Initiatives Boost Student Scores, Researchers Find," though it's not a ringing endorsement.
It's a big first step. Schools have been spending billions of dollars over the past decade or so to give devices and specifically laptops to all of their students, and making that investment with really very little understanding of how it's going to impact student learning. And to date, there's been a lot of skepticism and reason for discouragement about how big an impact that's making. What the researchers from Michigan State University did was take a look at 15 years worth of other studies and kind of use statistical analysis to put it all together, and what they found is that there are actually some really positive signs that giving every student a laptop might make a statistically significant difference in how they do in English and writing and math and in science.
Well, let's get to that, but you invoked skepticism on the part of many. What was that based on?
I think that one of the concerns is the amount of money that has been invested in giving students computers without realizing or knowing much of how they're actually used. There's also a lot of concern that there's a lack of training. And, you know, it's one thing to give every student a computer. It's a very different thing to know what to do with it and how to teach with it and how students might learn with it. And I think educators are very much in the process of still figuring that out. And there has been some research that has led to some doubt. There was a study recently, for example, that looked internationally and found that those countries where students, 15-year-old students who use computers in the classroom the most actually did the worst on global academic tests. So, you know, there's been a lot of discussion and debate, and this new study kind of is helping to reset that discussion a little bit.
But to reiterate, this is specific to laptops, not tablets, desktop computers, and smartphones.
That's correct. And what you'll find, if you kind of think about it from a practical sense, that makes a lot of sense. If you are using a laptop, you're able to type using a keyboard, and it's a lot easier to do kind of content creation and do some of the higher order things. It might be easier to do internet research. An iPad might let you do different things. And so this study, yes, looks specifically at laptop computers. And I think many schools and school districts are coming to the conclusion that for older students in particular, for middle and high schools, that laptops are the way to go, and that maybe for younger students, particularly in the early, you know, in the early years, iPads make a little more sense.
But how do we make sense of the importance of laptops in the context of so many other variables that might be important, say, class size or individual tutoring?
Well, what the researchers found is that, you know, using the statistical techniques that they used in the research, they were able to conclude that having laptops for every student in the classroom does make a difference in learning. But the scale was relatively small and the effect size was relatively small. And so what I mean by that is that there were only 10 studies that they were able to analyze to do this. So it's, you know, a positive signal, but not a definitive conclusion. And that when you compare the size of the gains that you're able to attribute to laptops, it's meaningful, but it's not necessarily as large as the gains you might be able to get by reducing class size or by providing every student with individual tutoring.
Then take us back to the Philadelphia region. Are there specific districts that have had this plan in place for a long time?
There are districts in the Philadelphia area that are one-to-one, and I think what you'll find you know, a lot more, particularly inside Philadelphia, is that there are individual schools that give every student a computer or a device. And, you know, I think you see a range. Right now, Chromebooks are probably the most popular device. They are like a laptop, but they don't host applications on them. They just are a web-based tool where you know, use Google-based tools. And the School District of Philadelphia has become a big fan of Chromebooks, like many other districts around the country, in part because they are relatively inexpensive.
Ben, we're focusing on specific test results. Are there other benefits that are more difficult to measure quantitatively?
When I talked to Binbin Zhang, who's the researcher at Michigan State University who led this study, she was actually most excited about the things that weren't test scores. So she said in their review of the research that they found some modest but meaningful evidence that giving laptops to students does things like make students write more and write better, to help shift classrooms towards more what they call student-centered or project-based instruction, which means that, you know, students get a little more decision-making in what they're learning and at what pace they're learning it, and that they get to do a little more hands-on work. And there's also some positive signs that giving laptops in schools can lead to students being more engaged and schools having better relationships with students' families. So there are a lot of quote-unquote soft benefits to giving computers as well, and I think that's where a lot of researchers and practitioners are going to be most focused in the near future.
Thanks, Ben.
Thanks for having me.
Education Week's Ben Harold on NewsWorks Tonight. Philadelphia has 48 zip codes, and everyone tells a story. We've been exploring some of those stories with our series, Every Zip Philadelphia. This evening, let's hear from Tanisha Reinhardt and Della Burns, two friends from Northwest Philly. Now in their 30s, they wanted to start jumping double dutch again because they missed playing their favorite childhood game. So they made a Facebook event called Philly Girls Jump, expecting a dozen or so friends to sign up. Instead, hundreds of people of all ages came out last month to jump rope together in Aubrey Park, zip 19138.
My name is Tanisha Reinhardt. I am co-founder of Philly Girls Jump.
My name is Della Burns. I'm also co-founder of Philly Girls Jump.
Double Dutch is something that, you know, growing up in Philadelphia, it's a love that we share. It's something that connected you to your friends. It's something that you got to be great at. Growing up in the neighborhoods of Philadelphia, you would just knock on whoever's door who had a girl in their household and say, hey, you want to jump rope? And that's how friendships are sparked.
For me, it wasn't like anything that I had to think about doing. We just did it. So at that time, everybody was jumping. So it's just something that you did. I went outside. I saw people jumping. I didn't know how to jump. They put me in.
Can I get a jump?
Yeah, they put me in the inside of the rope, and I think that helped build your confidence as well.
I just love the camaraderie of it. I love just being with a group of girls, and when we grew up, my brother used to jump too, but just kind of like being out with people. And it's something that it doesn't matter how old or how young or where you're from, everybody can just join in and have a good time.
I'm 25.
12.
I turned 50 in February.
I'm 53 years old.
9.
I'm 60 years old.
I am now 28.
And at 51 years old, I'm out here jumping.
It's different songs that each person sings. They have new songs that they started in the 1990s. Well, in the 1990s, I wasn't singing and dancing and jumping up on rope, so. Like they have one called Criminal Minded. I couldn't tell you what it's about, but that's just the new songs that are out.
Criminal Minded, you've been blinded. Looking for a shoe like mine, you can't find it. Mine costs more, yours costs less. Mine's for a locker and yours pay less.
You don't see kids jumping, you don't see girls jumping double dutch like they did when we were kids. And it was always so much fun. We played it from sun up to sundown.
We mentioned it to a couple of our co-workers mentioned it to their, you know, young daughters or their kids, and they had, like, no idea what it was. So we showed them videos, and they were just like, is that what old people do?
You know what, the kids today, all they do is they're either looking at their phones or their iPads or whatnot. But this is a good way to come out and learn how to communicate and talk to each other and to have fun.
Pussy player, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, up, 1, 2.
I like it about it is you can do different things in double dutch that you can do a single. Like you can do with, you can hop on 1 foot or you can do a crisscross or like do a dance in it. It's really fun.
I'm hoping that with this big kickoff, that this will start double dutch again. It's a dying art, and we don't want it to die out.
And indeed, the next Philly Girls Jump event will be held this Sunday in Germantown's Aubrey Park. Our story was produced by Avery Brookins. Every Zip Philadelphia is produced by WHYY and Finding America, a national initiative of AIR, the Association of Independents and Radio, with support from the Wincote Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Finally this evening, despite too much of a good thing last year, a Jersey Shore town is game to try again this weekend with its annual seafood festival. Now last June, a crowd of around 200,000 flocked to Belmar for the New Jersey Seafood Festival, overwhelming the small town whose resident population is a shade under 6,000. Now, that prompted Mayor Matt Daugherty to shut down the 1.5-square-mile Monmouth County Borough, ordering all incoming routes closed for 4 hours on the festival's final day. In an effort to reduce crowds at this year's event, the borough's council moved the festival to May with an unadvertised night for locals tomorrow. The council also eliminated a fireworks display and told its tourism director to curtail marketing of the event. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov and Kimberly Haas, with additional production from Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Tomorrow evening, we'll hear what's been on the minds of the American public this week with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup poll. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.